Most of the fixes require more lies. As the pharmacist stared at me and the cashier held my hand, I suddenly felt intense guilt about having a reproductive system. I felt like a deviant for doing what I thought was a smart thing. That night, my mother lectured me about how I'd embarrassed her, and she wouldn't listen when I reminded her that she'd told me to do it. I cried while she yelled at me, and I hated that I cried. And that night in my bed, I felt the collective eyes of the entire town watching me. I lived in a world with no hiding places. Friendliness engulfed everybody. The sun was still in the bottom of the lake. The township denied this truth, but also encouraged people to bundle up for the foreseeable future. They called it a cold front. But I knew. This is what a limb feels like when it goes necrotic. Mayor Randy told me to stop calling. He asked me to stop telling people the sun had fallen in the lake. They installed new lights everywhere. Officially, the lights had been installed for safety reasons. Now everything was too bright. I kept the shades at my house drawn at all times. The endless light drove the owls mad. They dive-bombed cars and attacked civilians, and even though the Audubon people were calling it a mystery, it seemed pretty clear. These were bird suicides. The lights were called a temporary measure. But temporary just means not yet permanent. When the Ice Age started, dinosaurs thought it was temporary. Eventually, everyone would give up on the sun and accept a life completely dependent on electric light and heaters and synthetic grass and vegetables grown in labs. Because what were we supposed to do? Just pick the sun up, strap it into a catapult, and send it back home? Victims, Part 1. Sarah R. lived on my street. I knew her family, but I did not know her well. She was very tall, and I sometimes worried that she would get bullied at school, that she would learn to hate herself for her height. By high school, her posture had been ruined because she'd taken to slumping forward to try to fit in. She was in the library during the shooting, and when he burst through the doors, she froze, just feet away from the barrel of his gun. Scott L. was my neighbor once. Back when we were young and lived in the apartments off Main Street. Back when everyone in their 20s wanted to live as close as possible to the one so-called vibrant stretch of town. I used to hear him through the walls, shouting at sporting events and at video games. But he never shouted at me. He was nice. He was a nice man with a dog and a collection of whimsical ties, and a tendency to cover his mouth with his hand when he spoke. People smiled when they saw him. He had been making a soda delivery when the shooting started. He died because he was in the way of a bullet intended for someone else. Colby D. lived in the house where I grew up. Two other families had lived there between mine and his, so my presence in the house had long been erased. The drawings on my bedroom ceiling painted over, my buried treasures in the backyard dug up and pawned. I drove past that house often, and I sometimes parked across the street to see what had changed, to try to understand why they replaced the antique wooden front door with an ugly green thing, why they'd removed my father's stained glass window from the parlor, why they had ripped out the tree I'd twice tried to climb and from which I'd twice fallen, twice breaking my left wrist. This was an unhappy place, and still I loved it, and felt protective of it. I wanted it to be exactly what I'd remembered, because I wanted to feel justified in my adolescent anger and loneliness. But the house gradually became a stranger. Time doesn't just change the way we look or the way we feel. It changes our insides and turns us into entirely new people. The past can be vicious, but at least it's a terror you already know. When they showed Colby's face on the news, I felt like a stepbrother had died. My own brother had nearly died many times, and each time I felt like God himself had reached down my throat and started squeezing my lungs. In his picture, Colby looked cocky and self-assured and frustratingly handsome. He looked like a boy whom the other boys would listen to. His mother had abandoned him when he was young, but his father was a kind man and generous, and he loved his children. When I watched them working together in their backyard, I saw every one of his motions was filled with the kind of love I didn't really believe existed until I saw it in person. I drove away before they could see me, but then I spent the rest of the day thinking, there are kind men in the world, and they are good, and his son will be kind also. You form bonds with people for all kinds of reasons, and sometimes the reason is that that person lives in a place where you used to live, and sometimes you can lie in bed and transport yourself back to that place and try to get inside his head and feel, in some way, connected. Katie O. worked in the science department. She claimed to have a disease that made her bones weaker than other people's bones, but she provided no documentation. She said the monthly treat of pizza in the teacher's lounge was discriminatory because she was allergic to garlic. The students loved her because she often napped through class, asking them to quietly read their books. She was unpleasant and unreliable, and at parent-teacher conferences she talked mostly about her weak bones. More than a few of us thought she was hiding an addiction to something. Did this mean she deserved to be shot? It did not mean she deserved to be shot. When I was 7, I read a book about a boy named Even Steven, and I became obsessed with the idea of fairness. I shouted at my parents and my friends and my teachers that things were not fair. Bedtimes, being forced to eat peas, not being allowed to have a salamander as a pet, having to help my father do yard work. One day, while I was wailing about some injustice, my father grabbed me by the arm and said, "Nothing's fair. Nothing has ever been fair. You don't hear me whining about it all the time." Sometimes people get shot, and most of them don't deserve it. Not in the cosmic justice sense, but the idea of cosmic justice itself is misguided. Cameron T. was unattractive, like his uncle Patrick, who had briefly been the most popular kid in my high school class. You're not supposed to say it when the kids are ugly, but some of them are. At 16, Cameron's uncle Patrick was able to grow a beard to hide his angular, asymmetrical face. By senior year, he had a full lumberjack's beard, and his hair was long enough to hang over his eyes. He played guitar and was the lead singer in 2 different bands that played gigs at out-of-town bars and hung out all night using fake IDs. He bought the beer for every party I ever went to. He was unpredictable and hard to trust. One day he would love you and say you were his only real friend. And the next he would be on stage singing a song about how he wished you were dead. Later he was diagnosed as bipolar, but at the time we just thought he was cruel. After a year of college he joined the army, and we all assumed he'd come back straightened out and in the best shape of his life. But he went AWOL after 3 months. The next time I heard about him, he was living in a trailer in the desert in Arizona, with 3 other people and 2 dogs. They were distributing canned goods to illegal immigrants. I saw him only a year or two ago, and he looked washed out, wispy, ground down. He told me he'd moved back to town near his family and was living on disability, spending most of his days posting videos of himself playing guitar online. Most recently, he posted 2 videos. One was an elegy for Cameron that is frankly not very good. And the other was a folk song about how we need to kill all the killers before the killers kill us first. Kirk B. got a 17-line obituary in the local paper. It focused on his public service, first as an Air Force pilot and later as a volunteer firefighter. None of the lines mentioned the strange pleasure he took in shooting squirrels with a BB gun, or the brief period when we all suspected he was living in his car in the parking lot and shaving over the sink in the teacher's lounge. Probably it's not relevant to an obituary to mention those things. I'm not sure what obituaries are for. You can tell people's stories, but nothing you do is complete or accurate. It's just a list of people they used to know and jobs they used to do. We spend so much time trying to be effective mourners, but we have no idea how to do it. Even elephants are better at mourning. June. 8 weeks after the shooting, I got an email from a man who called himself Patriot Paul, and who said, "I'm going to show up at your house one night when you're not expecting it, and I'm going to cut your whore mouth open with my Bowie knife and fill it up with dicks. I'm going to cover you in dicks and smother you with them, and when you're dead, I'll hang you over my mantle like a trophy." I wrote back and asked him where he gets all those extra dicks, and is there a wholesaler nearby because I could use a few spares. I got emails like this frequently. Middle-aged men saw news of the shooting and thought, "The world needs me now." They put on their capes and swooped into the rescue. But when they got there, they found out they had no superpowers. They were just sad men in capes. So they got angry and looked for a woman to blame. They were terrified, and they wanted to dress it up as courage, and they spewed hate into the world in hopes of drowning out the threats. They demanded explanations, and then before anyone had a chance to explain, offered their own theories. The shooter's mother had to explain herself to a dozen different news anchors, who all asked her questions like, "Where do you think you went wrong?" and "What advice do you have for mothers out there who don't want their sons to turn out like yours?" and "Do you have a message for the grieving families?" She had to beg forgiveness for having birthed a boy she didn't understand. The pundit said she had feminized the boy, that she had made him wear dresses when he was younger. They were Halloween costumes, she said, and it was only twice. That she had allowed him to go vegetarian and to quit the football team when he was 10. Could the boy have been saved by joining a couple sports clubs? Would he have been better off if he'd been adopted? Are some children just born evil? The shooter's mother had a name, though the media rarely used it. She became simply the mother of. He had robbed her of her right to define herself. Her name was Sylvia, an elegant name, the name of a VP of marketing or a conceptual artist with a small but enthusiastic following. She was tall and papery and rustled in the wind. She looked like an old rocker past her prime. She had excellent posture. She was 2 years younger than me. We'd grown up in the part of town everyone called the Mud Flats. People thought we were poor, because we were, but not as poor as they said. I rarely spoke to her because she was younger than me, and people said she was weird. She missed school frequently and always seemed to be sick. When I was in eighth grade and she was in sixth, a couple of boys in my class got in the habit of tormenting her by pulling her hair, throwing candy down her shirt, tossing her books out the bus window. Before the end of that school year, she was gone, and I later learned she had moved away to live with her grandparents while her parents got themselves sorted out. When she came back, her father was gone. In high school, she had a reputation for acting crazy, for taking dares from anyone, and sometimes turning up in random beds on Saturday mornings. She liked to party. But why should I have cared? Everyone liked to party. What else was there to do? About a year before the shooting, I saw Sylvia in the movie theater. She was there by herself, and I was there by myself, and I sat next to her because I wasn't comfortable being alone. We were seeing a big new action film about a young cop single-handedly stopping a drug cartel. We saw more than 300 people killed on the screen. She reached over and held my hand. Her hand was cold and flaky, and I felt like if I pulled hard enough, I could tear it off her arm. When the movie ended, she applauded, and afterward she kept telling me how great it was. She invited me out for coffee or wine. I wasn't sure I wanted to talk to her much more. Her eyes never stopped moving, and she chewed on her bottom lip. She didn't want to go to her own home. Before I left, she said, "Do you ever have kids at the school who say they hate their parents?" I told her that's the only thing some of them are capable of saying. When I was their age, I worked at hating my parents harder than I did on any other task. Teenagers would eat hate if they could. "But do you think they get better?" she said. "I don't understand the first thing about kids," I said. It wasn't until much later that I remembered that night and thought about how I could have been inside the house just down the hall from the boy as he was already plotting his murders. How I could have sat there with his mother, and maybe she would have even told me something about how terrifying her son was, how she had nowhere to hide from him. Everywhere around town, people were remembering their own brushes with the greatest villain we'd ever seen. I remembered the time I saw him at work with his mother at the dry cleaner. Some days he sat behind the counter doing homework. There was no one else at home to take care of him, so he had to stay with Sylvia while she worked. He was 12 then, the age when the police say he was already writing vile things on the internet. He handed me my blouses. He smiled at me, and he shook my hand. Once he'd murdered people, we were forced to account for him, to carve out a space in our brains where he would always live. I could see how this would appeal to him. I saw Sylvia only one time after the shooting at a gas station, where we'd both gone overnight to buy milk. Infamy makes grocery stores difficult, but gas station attendants don't ask questions at 2 a.m. They stand quietly and hope not to get robbed. Sylvia paid for my milk and apologized for what her son had done. I could see, even then, she was dying. She followed me to my car, apologizing again and again, and then she collapsed into my chest. I held on to her and kept her on her feet. The last time I'd had an experience like this in a parking lot was with a girl out celebrating her 21st birthday. She'd broken the heel on her shoe and had fallen to her knees in tears between two parked cars because she was too drunk to handle the stress of aging. I gave that girl my shoes, and she hurled herself at me the same way Sylvia had. She held on to me, and I held on to her, and she cried. It's the moral thing to keep holding on as long as the other person needs it. It's a way of affirming that we're human. You can try to hug a cat, but eventually you'll feel its claws. I got an email from an ex.
"I don't blame you for what happened," he said.
My life was now about seeking forgiveness for things I hadn't done. Maybe that's how it always had been, apologizing just in case I'd done something wrong, assuming I'd done a bad thing, even if nobody knew what it was. He also wanted me to know I looked great in the pictures they'd been showing on the news, and maybe would I want to catch up sometime.
"I'm sure you could use a friend," he said.
The ex was named Robert, but he liked to be called Robbie. Robbie is the name of a boy, a kid who wears his ball cap backward and sits in the bleachers at baseball games, sneaking cigarettes and spilling beer on bystanders as he jostles for foul balls. Robbie is not the name of an adult man who is ready to live with an adult woman. But he was very pretty. He was 10 years younger than me, and he had hair the color of Nilla wafers and skin like fondant, and I had dreams about eating him. I didn't think I would ever get to date a boy his age again. We'd first met at a coffee shop. Robbie was standing in line behind me. The barista was young and overwhelmed. She was panicking, so I offered to help her. I was more helpful in those days. I told her she needed to do something dramatic to make a statement.
She then tried to push the espresso machine off the counter, and it barely budged. I leaned over and helped her, and together we knocked it to the floor. The sound was exactly like that of an espresso machine crashing onto the floor. The girl started crying. She sank to the floor and tried to hide beneath the counter. Robbie tapped me on the shoulder and said, "You should probably get out of here." I followed him to his car, and then we went to a different coffee shop. And somewhere in there, I kissed him. When we were dating, Robbie was incapable of having an honest conversation with me until he was drunk. When he wanted to get serious, he would always have 3 to 4 more drinks than I did. I drank less then than I do now. At the time, I didn't really appreciate the benefits of intoxication. I was still under the impression that drinking had to be conducted socially. Most of our dates started awkwardly and tentatively, then turned nice for 2 hours before he switched to gin and tonic. And then he got sloppy and started talking too much. If I suggested he drink some water, he'd get suddenly defensive. Then in the morning he would wake up and say, "That last drink really hit me hard," which was his way of apologizing. He owned a collection of interesting pint glasses with boring origin stories. He chewed sunflower seeds compulsively because his doctor told him he needed more salt in his diet, and he spit the shells into an oversized plastic cup that stood on his table for weeks before he emptied it. I did laundry for him on the weekends. I sat across from Robbie in a diner booth, knowing everyone in the room was looking at me. He removed his hat, which I took to mean he was about to do something sincere. He reached across the table and held my hand. I was afraid he was going to propose to me. "This whole thing has been really bringing me down," he said. He squeezed my hand and pulled it closer. "It's just like, it makes you think." "What does?" I said. I knew what he meant, but I was tired of him not just saying what he meant. I was annoyed by the thudding dullness of the way people had talked about the killings, the practiced frowns and the miserable acceptance. There had to be a better way.
"You know, the whole big thing."
"The shooting?" I said. "At the school?
The school shooting?"
He let go of my hand.
"Come on," he said. "You know what I mean."
He pulled his phone out of his pocket and tapped out a message to someone. He looked down at it for another minute. I felt the weight of my own phone in my pocket, demanding I check it. Each time my phone buzzed, I thought it could be Calvin. Before the shooting, Calvin and I were on a schedule of 3 or 4 phone calls a year, and now he wanted to talk every week. He kept sending me messages saying he was worried about me. He didn't understand that his worry only made me feel worse, because I knew I was inflicting my unhappiness on him. Robbie reached across the table again.
"Look, listen. I'm trying here, okay?"
Robbie wanted me to congratulate him for being sad about a mass murder. Men want to be rewarded for having emotions. They think it's an accomplishment to have sincere thoughts and feel sad about things. When we left the coffee shop, we picked up a bottle of vodka and returned to his apartment. We drank for a long time, and at some point we were both crying, and then I was demanding that he fuck me, and then he was inside me, and then he wasn't, and then I felt sick from the alcohol. In the morning, he tapped me on the shoulder and said,
"I have a surprise for you."
I was not looking for any more surprises in my life. He presented me with a platter of bacon, toast, eggs. He didn't stand there waiting for me to thank him the way he might have back when we lived together. He just performed the nice gesture and then allowed it to exist. Eggs are chickens that haven't been born yet. You eat them, and then inside you they are born and your body is filled with birds. If you eat too many, your stomach bursts open and the birds escape and fill the sky above your body. I picked at the eggs and said thank you. I remembered, while I was lying in Robbie's bed, that it was Calvin's son's birthday. Calvin had two children, a 4-year-old boy named Harlan and a 2-year-old girl named Colleen. I had only met Harlan once at his christening. I was his godmother, for reasons I never understood. I remember standing in the church next to the baptismal font and fearing the whole time the priest would ask me to explain myself. The sacraments are supposed to fill you with grace, to make you feel God's love. I felt exposed in the priest's presence, judged by the hovering Christ in the stained glass window behind the altar. They say Jesus ascended to heaven, but nobody ever saw where he went. You're supposed to have faith, but nothing is more dangerous than faith. That day was the only time I had ever seen Calvin's new home in his new city. I had never met his daughter, though I'd seen the pictures. I had met his wife a few times before that. He'd been introduced to Nina by a friend after one of his meetings. She was a social worker, with a degree in library science, a sleeve of tattoos, and a tiny stud in her nose. And in the most recent pictures I'd seen, she had green hair. She looked very cool. She looked like someone who knew about interesting movie festivals and who could get backstage at concerts. I was certain she didn't like me. On Harlan's birthday, it was my job to send a card with a $50 check. It was my job to call Calvin and ask him to put Harlan on the phone so I could wish him happy birthday while he stood in silence, confused, like most children, by what he was supposed to say to someone on the phone. According to the priest, I was also supposed to provide spiritual guidance to him. I texted Calvin to say I was a little hung up, but I would call later. And he responded right away.
"We don't ask for much," he wrote.
Robbie kissed me on the top of my head and said,
"Babe, stop crying."
Was I crying?
"I'll take care of you."
His apartment still looked like a college dorm room. The backward hat and gym shorts, which looked fine on him in his mid-20s, now seemed like a sad affectation of youth. I don't think he wanted to take care of me, so much as he wanted me to tell him how safe he made me feel. He rarely wore shirts indoors, and though his body was not as beautiful as it had once been, I still wanted nothing more than to feel it on top of me, to be pressed so close to me that our skins melted together.
"I have to go," I said. "Right now?"
I took his spare key and said, "I'll bring this back." "Time to heal," the newspaper headline said. It read like an order. The community was tired of sympathizing. The bodies had been buried. The prayer services and vigils had been conducted. The speeches from politicians. The threats of copycat attacks. The benefit concert. It had been 2 months. Everyone wanted to move on. There were other things to worry about. We all had lives with real issues and problems before the shooting, and those things were still there, unchanged, except for this one big thing we were supposed to be getting over. And we couldn't. It occluded everything like a cataract.
"Do you remember when everything used to be simple?" a woman at the bus stop asked me.
July. I'd become suspicious of knocks on my door, so when I heard a knock, my first instinct was to dive behind my couch. The knocking persisted. I crawled toward the door, then stood to look through the peephole. On the other side of the door, I saw Angie Sparks. Angie used to work as a clerk at the high school. 5 years ago, she'd gone back to school to get a business degree and opened a small clothing boutique downtown. I hadn't thought about her since the grand opening of her shop. Back then, she was really into Buddhism. Her shop was full of items that could be vaguely described as spiritual. Now, she was something else. "Anna," she said when I opened the door, "have you found Jesus yet?" "I've been looking all over for him, but can't turn him up."
You're letting your cynicism blind you.
I was hoping my cynicism would be the thing that kept me alive.
May I have permission to enter your home?
Angie said.
You're not a vampire, are you? Because you have to tell me, otherwise it's entrapment.
Not even a smirk. Angie reached into the breast pocket of her jacket. Everyone was wearing jackets now, with the sun gone. And I was sure she was reaching for a gun. Every day I saw people making sudden moves, and then the shooting flashed by in tiny explosions in my brain. I saw the shooter with the gun stalking the halls, and I heard the children screaming for help, and I tasted the blood on my tongue. I sometimes saw myself with the gun, jolting backward when I pulled the trigger. I traced his steps through the school, banging on lockers and laughing and firing wildly in the air like a western bandit. The shooter tore through the gauzy curtain of security that made me think I was in a safe place, that made me think there was some way I could live without fear. I saw John Kay seeing the gun and running toward it, putting himself between the bullets and the students. He was a hero. And being a hero didn't make him any less dead.
I'd like you to read this, Angie said, and I'd like to talk to you about it.
It was a pamphlet about the apocalypse titled, Signs Preceding the End of the World. I told her if we were going to do this, I would need a drink. Was it brunch time? Was it Sunday? I had a mimosa, and I had some kind of egg dish sitting in front of me. When the waiter asked me how I was doing today, I said I was fine. He said he was also fine. Angie was fine, too. Everybody was fine.
Time is running short, Angie said. You need to repent and accept Christ into your life.
She'd said this several times already. She was very big on repenting. Does the repent now thing ever actually work for recruiting? I said.
I mean, no, not really. But it should.
I sliced my eggs open and watched the yolk run like blood over the hash browns. Do you think Jesus has a gun?
I don't see why he wouldn't.
Angie sipped her mimosa. I thought evangelicals didn't drink alcohol. But maybe Angie hadn't committed fully yet. Or maybe there were exceptions for recruiting trips.
He probably has a whole mess of guns, because how else would he fight off Satan?
Satan has guns too?
And tanks, probably.
Angie told me I was in limbo. She said once I accepted that Jesus would save me from myself, I would feel decades of unhappiness lifted from me. I would be weightless and ascend to a higher plane. She told me a parable about a mole and a duck. But I wasn't interested in parables. I was not a mole or a duck. I was a person with a real problem. Parables are for children. I'd seen people panic about the end of times before. For 6 months leading up to Y2K, my father had mailed me newspaper clippings about our impending doom. He never included a note, though sometimes he drew smiley faces next to the headlines. Calvin sometimes spent the night at my apartment to get away from them, and he said the house was filling up with canned goods. My father wanted to be ready. My mother didn't care enough to stop him. After it happened, after nothing happened, my father's notes stopped. My mother, I was told, opened the cans one by one and poured them into the sink, the garbage disposal running nonstop through the night. Part of me wanted to laugh at Angie. Part of me knew the moment you start screaming that the end is near, your life becomes entirely about death. But this time felt different. I read the pamphlet and I thought, why not? Why wouldn't the world end now? It has to end eventually. Why shouldn't we be the ones to see it? The pamphlet named all the usual signs of apocalypse: flooding, wildlife rebellion, fires, rampant shootings, amorality. and included lots of frightening line graphs. There was also the sun to think about. That seemed like a very scientific reason to give up on the future. In other cities, the sun was still there. It didn't make sense, but there's no reason anything ever has to make sense. We're the ones who try to force sense onto the world. According to the literature, the end would look like a movie. A sudden darkness, a portal from hell, demons pouring out, a bloody battle between the forces of good and evil. You might want to make this sound less exciting, I said. I kind of want to not repent, just so I can see the whole scene. I think you're missing the point. Make it sound boring. People don't want to be bored. Angie snatched the pamphlet away. I don't deserve to be mocked for my beliefs, she said. I am a person. I vote. I speak to Jesus every night. She emptied her glass. What do you do? My house was still in disarray. I'd never considered myself an orderly person, but I had never lived in such a mess before. I knew my house needed to be cleaned, but the thought of starting the job overwhelmed me. My mother believed a clean house was a sign of a clean soul. She cleaned my room while I was out, and I dirtied it to spite her. And by the time I was 18, she'd given up on both me and my soul. My family used to go to church every week. My mother made us dress up, even though Catholics didn't care how you dressed. Showing up to church in Seldom Falls is a good way to advertise yourself to the community as happy and well-adjusted. I never knew if anybody believed in what we were doing on Sundays. My father sang the hymns out of tune, and he kept his eyes closed the whole time he sang. Calvin sat next to me, and my mother sat next to Calvin. And when Father Graham told us to sit, we sat. When he told us to kneel, we knelt. I read the hymnals and memorized the songs. My mother never took communion. Calvin never prayed. Every Christmas we went to the midnight mass, and it would get so crowded with half-drunk, lonely people that the air in the room became oppressive. Most years I passed out from the heat. My mother thought this was a sign of my religious fervor. When I woke up, she would be smiling at me, saying, I always knew you had a saint inside you. One time when I passed out, my head hit the pew in front of me. That's why I have a scar above my eye. A man told me once he thought it was sexy and mysterious. He traced it with his finger. He said, I love a woman with scars. After 11 weeks, the investigation of the shooter was officially closed. The manifesto he'd written had told them everything, particularly who he hated and why. It was a list depressing in its banality, in its adolescent conviction that he'd discovered some grand truth about how people are phonies, how organized religion corrupts, how the world is mostly about pain. As if we didn't all know this, as if we also weren't trying to find ways to deal with it that didn't involve murder. In his manifesto, he talked about loneliness, as if that problem had been invented to torment him alone. He talked about being smarter than everyone else. He talked about wanting to open people's eyes to all the terrible things he'd learned online. If you spend too much time online without stepping away, it's like stepping into the midday sun with dilated pupils. There is too much to take in, and no way to process everything, and all you know is that it hurts and you need to get away. We're supposed to be gradually exposed to the world's horrors, so that over time we can develop an immunity. We learn about failure and loss and cruelty and rejection and inferiority in a sequence. If you hit a kid with all of that at once, how is he going to survive? He'd left everything piled on a dresser in his bedroom, along with a picture he'd asked them to use on the news, in which he'd posed with his arms crossed over his chest, pistols in each hand, like he was on the poster for a war movie. The shooter had a name and a face and a past, Everyone knows his name and face and select parts of his past. But what they didn't talk about was that the shooter was a boy. He was a boy in a world in which boys play by pretending to kill other boys. He was a boy with access to military-grade firepower, but not to an adult support system or psychiatric services. Boys kill, and they kill, and they kill, and then they kill again. Boys are made of snails and puppy dog tails and pipe bombs and semi-automatic rifles. Girls are made of sugar and spice, and who knows what else? Their anatomy is a mystery. What did I want to be when I was young? I wanted to be a very tall person. I wanted to be a robot with the power to self-destruct. I wanted to be a lizard lying on a rock and sticking its tongue out lazily while other animals steered clear of me. I wanted to be the moon and only show parts of myself and go into hiding periodically and control the tides. I wanted to flood cities and reflect the sun back onto everyone. I wanted to be something people aspired to. Before I went back to college, Calvin's addiction had already taken over his life and ours. Even though I was an hour away at school, his problems bled into my world. My mother called to complain about him every day, and every time she kicked him out of the house, he stayed in my dorm. My roommate hated the idea of having a strange man sleeping on the floor of her room, and she knew just from looking at him that he was an addict. Everyone has terrible compulsions, but most people can hide them, quarantine them to specific, safe areas of their life. The third time he slept there, he stole jewelry from my roommate, and I was kicked out of campus housing. I've never been able to say no to him. When he was 11, I would buy beer for him and his friends on weekends, and I was the first one to give him pot. Back then, it was very important to me that he see me as a cool older sister. I felt I owed him, because his life had been too hard already, and too much of it was my fault. Even if I had known it would escalate the way it did, I might still have done everything the same way. It's a mistake to look at your past and imagine alternate outcomes, because time machines don't exist. And even if they did, only the rich could afford them. I decided to be a teacher because of Calvin, because I was still idealistic then and thought I could make amends for him by saving other children. In my life, I have never been more committed to anything than I was to teaching at age 23. For a few years, I even did it very well. Robbie asked me to take a bike ride with him. He said we both needed more fresh air. "You look like you haven't been outside in a year," he said. "Outside," I reminded him, "is where you go to get killed." "God," he said, "you're always so, what's the word?" I did not know the word. "Starts with an M, you know what I mean." I wore a helmet, and he didn't. I figured I should control the variables I could control. You can't stop a shooter from rampaging, but you can wear a helmet in case you fall off a bike and hit your head on a rock. Robbie was a natural athlete. He'd played two sports in college and bounced when he walked. He never looked more comfortable in the world than he did when he was running or biking or swimming or dribbling a ball. He had to keep slowing down to let me catch up. But I preferred the view from last place, enjoyed seeing him so competent and capable and physically impressive. The muscular bulge of his calves, the tension in his hamstrings, and the sculpted lines of his arms braced on the handlebars. Since I was a child, I've admired men who are supremely competent at minor tasks. My father sawing wood precisely. My brother dicing an onion in seconds. My first boyfriend flying a model airplane through an obstacle course. My mind emptied. I pedaled with the thoughtless momentum of a machine. My legs are machines, and they pump up and down and they carry me where I tell them to. My arms are bone and flesh and blood and ligaments, and they are tools I use to pick things up, to balance myself, to push things away. My heart is an engine that ignites and propels me forward, even when I don't want to be propelled. We'd been riding for about an hour, and I needed a break. We were a few miles out of town on a nature trail that connected a Civil War battlefield to a memorial from a different war. We propped our bikes against a tree.
"I should have brought a picnic or something," he said. "My bad."
I had told him many times that I don't need romance and I'm not interested in being courted. But a picnic sounded nice. The thought of him thinking of it, even belatedly, was nice. My shirt clung sweaty to my breasts, and I shivered in the breeze. The grass rustled near us, and I was sure for a moment that it was a snake, that I was about to feel its fangs in my calf, and that would be that. It felt like decades ago since I had last been able to enjoy something. It was not a snake. It was a bunny, hopping away wide-eyed. A hawk circled overhead and contemplated swooping down on the moving target. Somewhere not far, there was a fox, hiding and waiting for a scared rabbit to come scampering into its jaws.
"Your nose is bleeding again," Robbie said.
A week before the bike ride, I'd woken up with blood smeared across my pillow and on my face, and I was sure I'd been murdered overnight. When Robbie saw the blood-encrusted pillowcase, he nearly vomited, and then he told me I needed to see a doctor. The body needs to process the trauma, too. I stopped wearing white shirts and started carrying a handkerchief in my back pocket. I dripped trails of blood all over Robbie's apartment. In the grocery store, I was hustling to fill my cart with canned goods. I thought this would be one step to building a bomb shelter. And a young woman grabbed my arm. She leaned in close and whispered, "Is he here?" I thought she was another evangelical. I thought she was talking about Jesus. "I'm not really sure. Isn't he supposed to be everywhere?" I said. "You can get help," she said. "I've read the pamphlets, sure." She squeezed my arm. "I'm serious. Take this," she said, stuffing a business card in my hip pocket. "I've been there." She wouldn't let go until I made eye contact with her and promised to call the number on the card. As she walked away, I tasted a drop of blood in the corner of my mouth, and then I understood how I looked. There are days when you feel the whole world is staring at you, but they're not. And then there are the other days. The card she'd given me was for a shelter for battered women. Later, I told Robbie about the misunderstanding.
"Why are you laughing at that?" he said. "How could it possibly be funny that people think I'm beating you?"
He never really appreciated my jokes. Through the first few months, I tried to have my breakdowns in private. Did I even have a right to mourn a mass killing that didn't kill anyone I loved? I wasn't there to witness it. But I still wake up and feel it, convinced it's the only thing I've ever seen. I will have a drink in the afternoon, and then I will think about how I could have been there, and maybe I should have been there. I never had any desire to be a hero or a martyr. But wouldn't everyone have been better off if I'd been killed instead? It was the only thing I thought about. My ears only heard gunshots. My lungs were full of bullets. One is meant to be stoic after a tragic event, if tragic is even the right word. One should keep calm, etc. While waiting for a latte, I heard the barista call my name, and I waited so he could call again, because I wanted to hear my name expressed publicly and loudly, and without judgment. I wanted to hear my name and affirm that I existed. And then, before I could take the latte, I felt a wave of gratitude so powerful, it broke me in half. And then I felt guilt for feeling good in the wake of a tragedy, if tragedy is even the right word. But to have a stranger talk to me like a normal person and to be polite and even smile at me was such a relief. How to be safe. Part 1. Every night before bed, make sure all your windows and doors are locked. Blow out every candle. Turn off your stove and your oven. Check outlets and light switches for loose connections. Cut strategic holes in the drywall to inspect for black mold. Search your toilet for stowaway snakes. Check your windows again. Set up a series of booby traps between your bed and the front door. Pray to whichever god is most likely to protect you from harm. Make peace with the ghosts in your home. Remove all suffocation hazards from the vicinity of your bed. There should be no plastic bags near your bed. Keep a phone on your bedside table pre-dialed to 911. Take a sleeping pill so you can get through the night, but don't take too many. In the morning, check your windows again. Never go online. Online, there are hordes of bored teenagers who want to terrorize you for laughs. There are angry young men who fantasize about flaying you and inserting themselves into you and desecrating you. The joke is on them. The body is not sacred. It can't be desecrated. There are lonely adults who sit like snipers waiting for the perfect moment to destroy you. There are identity thieves who will wear you like a mask and then discard you so someone else can find you at the bottom of a trash can. Never go online, because if you go online, you'll never be able to hide again. But also never go outside. Try to find a way to live on a plane of existence inaccessible to the rest of the world. Get yourself some money. As much as you can. Money is insulation. Money allows you to go to a doctor regularly and eat food that is made out of food. Money helps you live in places far away from danger. Money buys security systems and guard dogs and walls and moats. Money buys the legal right to shoot people who look scary. There are walls within walls that you can only see if you have enough money. Money buys an elaborate funeral. When you're dead, you get to keep your three most valuable items from life, so that when you're in heaven, you can be sure everyone knows still that you were rich on earth, that even here, you're not somebody to mess with. Try to grow wings. Spend your days thinking bird-like thoughts. Watch videos of birds in flight. Communicate exclusively via chirps and squawks. Eventually, if you're lucky, you will feel the nubs of the wings sprouting like crocus buds, peeking above the springtime soil. When you can fly, you can avoid the terrors of land-based travel and shelter yourself in the tallest trees. As long as you're bigger than an eagle, you will have no natural predators in the sky. But no matter how high you fly, how much you conceal your nest, there will always be men on the ground with guns and bullets and the desire to destroy your muscle and tendons and ligaments with those bullets. They will camouflage themselves and hide for days in trees just for the chance to kill you and stuff you with polyurethane foam and then mount you on their walls. You are a trophy. You are a story a man can tell while he smokes a cigar with his buddies. August. Bomb threats closed down most of Seldom Falls one afternoon. A suspicious package was found at the corner of Main and Buttonwood. A suspicious car was parked at the end of the 200 block of Cherry Avenue. A dark-skinned individual was seen acting suspiciously in front of Holmes's pharmacy. Most of the calls about suspicious activity in town were about dark-skinned men, even though the shooter himself had been a pale white boy. The most dangerous thing someone could do was walk through Seldom Falls with a different skin color. The dark-skinned man at the pharmacy was surrounded by SWAT teams. The police rolled down Main Street in a military ATV. There were bomb-detecting robots. There was a controlled explosion. The man was detained and questioned on suspicion of terroristic activity. Later, when they released him, he had to move to a new town because the people here still believed he was guilty. I watched it all from behind the police barrier. I saw the snipers on the roof. I prepared to feel the shrapnel under my skin, to take on the suffering of others, not to be a hero, but to fit in. At that time, I still had delusions of importance. I thought being bombed would inspire something in somebody. Around the perimeter, men cocked their guns, waiting for the opportunity to kill an authentic bad guy. Seldom Falls had increased the size of the police force by 50% since the shooting. They put recruits in an accelerated training program, and they waived the background check for anyone who could pass the written test on the first try. Officers with little training were armed and ready to protect, to serve. Arrests skyrocketed. This was cited as evidence of improvement. Trials were expedited, so people could go to jail faster. Periodically, Mayor Randy announced that they had reason to believe there was a credible threat to Seldom Falls, though he could not tell us what kind of threat or how he knew. He told us to act normally. Acting strangely would allow the terrorists to win. Everyone had become obsessed with this game we were playing with terrorists. We'd started counting our wins and losses like sports fans, though nobody could agree what counted as a win or a loss. He told us to also be wary of strangers and to immediately report any suspicious behavior. Later, they would announce someone had been detained and we had been saved from another attack. Nobody knew why, but after decades of relative safety, our township was under siege. I was 16, the last time Seldom Falls had endured a major crisis, when the lake overflowed and flooded half the town. It was the end of winter. The snow mounds on the side of the road were tall enough that I couldn't see over most of them. It rained for 10 straight days, melting the snow and saturating everything within a mile radius of the lake. Our house was just outside the areas that got the worst damage, but our basement flooded, and Calvin and I were hauling buckets full of water outside, pointlessly, all day. For every bucket we dumped outside, the same amount of water was pouring in through our foundation. Calvin was too young to be helpful for long. He got tired, and his hands calloused, and my mother screamed at him to hustle before we lost everything. "Why don't you make yourself useful?" she yelled. He dropped his full bucket on the living room floor and went outside to cry in the yard. My father was not home, but when Calvin cried, he hid in the yard, so he wouldn't be yelled at for being too sensitive. We didn't know where my father was during the flood. My mother ran to her bedroom and changed into a swimsuit, then dove into the murky water, searching for something. She emerged like some kind of monster, hugging a ruined cardboard box against her body. I went outside to find Calvin and rub his back until he calmed down and caught his breath, until he felt comfortable enough to go back inside. Later, I sneaked into my mother's bedroom to see what was in the box. There was a Bible and a rosary blessed by the Archbishop. There were two photos of her and my father when they were young and optimistic and had perfect skin. Everyone has to hold on to at least one picture like that so they can prove they existed, so they can say, "I wasn't always like this." The flood destroyed about 100 homes and seriously damaged a lot more. 8 people died, and the hospitals overflowed with injured and sick people. It was the kind of disaster people would talk about for the rest of their lives. Classes at the high school were canceled for 3 weeks so students and faculty could help clear rubble. It was the hardest I'd ever worked in my life. We spent days